So, assalamu alaikum, peace be upon you. This is how we Muslims greet each other, and we greet people with peace. Thank you so much. I'll start with one of my poems from the book, I Am a Visitor on This Earth, and we are all visitors on this earth. The poem's title called I Am. I am a spot of light when the world disappears into the darkness of existence and the beginning of eternity. I am a bit of azure in the palm of a blushing bride and the warm heart of a noble lover. I am a cloud rebelling against the sky, stealing rain and escaping the thrusting fish in the passionate sea. I am a prayer. I am a prayer fixed in my mother's heart, a prayer she inherited from my tender grandmother, who stored prayers in her Kurdish gowns and gave them to us with sweets. I am a desired constellation. My orbits are irregular. I grant my stars and planets the freedom to dance without an axis. I am truth. I am truth that changes constantly in the hands of revolutionaries who rage against falsehood and illusion. I am a free dervish. I am a free dervish, an aquamarine twilight embracing the earth. Thank you so much. I would like to thank all of you for inviting me here. It's an honor to be standing here sharing the light of this room and the light of the universe with you. Breathing the same air that makes us be alive, and also sharing the peace in your heart that I feel while I'm standing among you. It's an honor for me to stand here and to share with you some of the thoughts and pieces of the story of my life that made me, or formed me, shaped me to be who I am now. I came from Iraq, from the northern part of Iraq, city called Erbil, from a Kurdish mother and an Arab father. So I came from an interrace, probably two ethnic groups, family, that they met back in the 50s, and they started a family, and I'm number 9 of 10 kids. I am blessed because from the beginning of my life, I was blessed to be alive. I wasn't supposed to be alive. I was born and I was sick. And before me, two of my younger sisters died. So my mother was waiting for me patiently, and then I was sick again. So she thought that I will die like my sisters. But she took me to a religious man, we call him Sheikh, and he read a prayer on me, and that prayer supposed to protect me. And my mom was telling me that the moment I get you out from his house, your cheeks start blushing and you were alive. So I know I am a living prayer that was answered. And she named me Faiza, which means in Arabic, the winner. And she meant that I won on death and I didn't die, and I was her prayer that was answered. So she raised me in this way, along with my 8 siblings. They all raised me. I know I was blessed because I received love from everybody. And when you see receive love from everybody, the only thing that you can give back is love too. I know we all struggle in our lives to define love. And what is love? Is it just a word that, or is it just a feeling? Is it love a passionate thing that you feel towards the other person, or is it something that you need to share to fix this world? I learned that very early when I was a child. Of course, being from Iraq, it means you came from a land that is all war and destruction. And those things came not from love, it came from hate, of course, and from the dark powers, what we can call that, the ego of people leads you to do destruction instead of our role on this earth is to build and to know each other. That's what the Quran is teaching us. We are in Christianity, in other religion, we're the children of God, and we are here for a purpose. Our purpose is to build this earth and to live together and know each other. That's why we are different. So when I was 8 years old when the war started with Iran, 8 years of war, being a child, going to school and waiting for the bomb that I could see from the jet planes, and seeing destruction and all that evil power that was it. That's all I could see from day to day, and it lasted for 8 years. So in a way I was formed as a child surrounded with love and protection of my family, but once there are things that was under they couldn't control, my family couldn't control, that's where I was. It was war and destruction, and from that point I learned how to resist. And to resist a power power of destruction that is made because of a decision of a politician was not easy. It means that you put your life and your family's life in danger too, because you are not you are not going with what the dictator Saddam was at that time oppressing the Kurds, and we wanted to voice ourselves that we don't accept his decision. So it was a hard time to resist. These kind of difficulties that I went through as a child, and then through, you know, being a teenager, the war was there. I had 2 years of peace, which was from 1988 to 1990, the beginning of the first Gulf War. These 2 years were like the most I remember every single day of it, because there was celebration in everywhere. In the street, when the war ended, people were happy because they can start a new life, not knowing that in another 2 years we will be in another big war, when the second war starts, which is the first Gulf War, the second war for me, I was in college at that time. I had to go through the difficulties being, the beginning of being a very young person, full of life, full of dreams, and waiting for the moment that they shut down all the university. And I was a student at the University of Mosul. I know some of you may be following the news what's happening in Mosul. This is the city where I studied for 5 years, and the University of Mosul was my university. And I had to farewell people, and not knowing if you're going to see them or not again. And I remember one friend in particular. He didn't have the chance to meet me because we were all traveling, getting ready to go to our cities, back to our cities. The war is starting. And he didn't have the chance to say goodbye to me. And we were thinking that, okay, we will, or I will meet him again, maybe when the war ends. It took us 6 months till the war, and the next year we came back to school, not knowing that the friend that didn't have the chance to say goodbye to me, he died when he was fleeing with his family and being in a mountain. He died from, he couldn't wake up in the morning because of cold. He died from being cold. That's how we heard about his death. It was painful. When I graduated, my first work as an interpreter started. That was during the sanction on Iraq. That sanction that killed 500,000 kids from hunger. And Iraq, a wealthy country, God blessed us with oil, with a lot of other resources, but at the same time we had bad and leaders who took us to wars one after another. And my first interaction was as an interpreter. My first job working with an American NGO who people came, were people of faith who came to help the kids, the children, and provide some food and milk to the children's hospital in Erbil. And my job was a translator. Every day I had to witness saying goodbye to a child, and the next morning came, the child passed away. It was a heartbreaking job that I did. In 1996, there was another civil war between the Kurds now, and that time I was an interpreter. And being an interpreter working with the American is a crime in Iraq, in Saddam's era. And there was a death penalty if you get caught. So one of the Kurdish political party invited the troops, the Saddam's troops, to come and invade my city and take over the city and hand it to them. And it was 6 a.m. in the morning. We woke up. We saw the tanks in our streets. And Saddam is back to the Kurds. And the first thing is, well, I'll be killed now. I work with the Americans as a translator. The first thing that the army did, they gathered 450 young people who worked with the opposition against the regime, and they executed them on spot. And that's when I really felt, this is it. This is now the second round. They're going to come to the translator because we are traitors now for the new regime. So the director of the organization, Mr. Bell, who's from Washington State, sent us an urgent request that we need to leave the city in a couple hours. The only thing you have to take with you is a small luggage that you can gather anything, and you cannot bring your family. I was 25, single, just graduated from school. So I had a luggage, a small one, and I wanted to take what I can take with me. And at that time, I stand, not knowing what is going to be, where I'm going to go, and I'm leaving my family. And we're talking about a Middle Eastern woman who never seen a plane before. Because of war in Iraq, we were like in a prison, a big prison. We cannot go out. I didn't have passports. And this is, I have to choose between being with my family or I have, or and probably be prosecuted and then executed, and or to leave to the unknown. But what did I have with me to take to prepare me for that journey? It was my faith. It was my submission to the only God. Oh God, now I have you. I have faith, and I will depend on this, on you, and I will go to the new path that, well, I didn't choose, but it's my new path. And I took two books with me. The first one was the Holy Book of Quran, and the second book was the collection poetry of Rabindranath Tagore, if you know him. He's a poet from Nepal. He's a great poet. Very, very... his poetry is all about love of God. And he won the Nobel Prize, too. These two, that's the only two books I could take with me because of the size, but that's what I chose. It's my journey. And I took the journey. We went to the border, city border, and then at that time it was President Bill Clinton's second term, and the Congress were discussing if we are eligible, if our life is danger, because we work with the American, and they could evacuate us, the Congress say no, and there were people trying very hard with the Congress to get us out from the country, from danger. We were about 5,000 people, translators and people who are the position of the regime. And I remember we were about 25 people in a two-bedroom apartment house. And we stayed for four months away from our families. We were just there waiting to be evacuated. And the voice of America at that time, we were listening to them, they said, the Congress says that the, because they were discussing our case, that we are not eligible. There's no danger in their life and we are not evacuating them. So everybody started crying and everybody said, we are done. We lost everything and we will be killed too. And now the U.S. is not backing us. We work with them and they are not backing us to bring us here. And I went out, I was sitting in the garden and I saw this huge butterfly. Came from nowhere and just landed in front of me. The butterfly had one wing and the second wing, this much left from the second wing, and it was flying. And I looked at the butterfly, and I saw that butterfly flying with one wing. I ran to the house again. I told everybody, we are flying. And everybody said, oh, crazy, you crazy again. You just say, because I am so connected with nature, and I do see signs. Everything for me, when you are very connected to everything around you, you will feel things that coming to you. So they would say, no, oh my God, we just see it from the news. There's no way. They're not taking it. I said, I saw a butterfly with one wing. We are flying too. Of course, nobody believed me. 2 hours later, our director, our local director came. He said, I just got a phone call. Pack. We are the first group to go. Tomorrow, there will be a bus coming. Take us to Turkey. From there, we will be evacuated by the U.S. Army. Nobody believed him. Of course, I did. I said, I told you so. I'm bringing this story because it's about when you depend in hard time, you depend and you go to your faith. Your faith is the core of everything that's happening, the core of your existence, and then everything that's happening. Sometimes you have control of little things or big things, and sometimes you don't have any control. So I arrived here by myself, and I came here with $20 in my pocket and a smile on my face. That's how I started. I landed in San Francisco, and I got my first job within the first 5 minutes being in the airport. They saw me, I was volunteering, helping the group that they came with me translating. So they wanted to hire me to help with the arrival of other groups from the camp. And that's how I did. I stayed there for 1 month, and then I came here, and I've been here for 20 years. I just celebrated my 20th here being in the United States. So I came here in a country that I do know the language, but I don't know the culture. The only culture I know about the Americans is through movie in Hollywood. And you know how it is. Right? So my family were very afraid, like, oh my God, you are going to the moon, and they were like, they think I'm going to be in the skyscrapers, and there's the alleys, and there will be people, you know, following me, and everything that is in the movies. That's how the culture, that's how media presenting a culture to you. It's not just you are getting the wrong ideas about the Middle East or the other place. We got the wrong ideas about you there too. But it was from you too. It was these ideas coming from the media, but it was your media telling us who you are. They defined. So you were defined through the Hollywood movies to us. Well, that's how America is. Or through the, you know, the images of war and you know, the soldiers are coming, or the atrocities that sometimes it happens. So this is America. I knew another America because I worked with the Americans. I worked with people I had a personal connection with people. That personal connection, and they were Christians, and they had faith. And I, you know, we were agreeing on everything. And we could, and at the beginning when I worked, I wasn't wearing scarves. I didn't wear scarves. I started wearing scarf when I was working with the agency. And one morning they saw me showing with the scarves, and I'm covered, like, what happened? Nothing. I just now practicing, you know, what the Quran's telling me, and took me 1 year until I get, you know, get agreed with the verse who says that you need to be covered, and I am doing it for the love of God. And that was it. When I said it is for the love of God, they understood. I'm doing this not because I'm oppressed, not because somebody is telling me to do that, not because my husband is telling me doing that. No. I did it with my own free will. Because if God wanted to create all of us the same, He could do it. He can do everything. But He created us different colors, different cultures, different languages, and different faiths. Because He wanted us to accept each other and to know each other. And to choose. We have choice. In Islam, and probably it's the same in Christianity, angels don't have choice. They are created to worship God only. We, on the other hand, we were created as a very unique being to have the ability to choose. But then there's a right path and there's the other path. And we have the choice. And this choice and this freedom that we have, it's very big. It is what our being is. It is why we are human. Because we can choose. And when you choose something, you choose it, it's very valuable because it's your choice. It's not somebody else that's oppressing you to do so. And probably you guys, because you were brought in a free society, that you had choice in most of you in all your life. It is a very natural thing for you. But for us, we came from an oppressed regime that lasts for 33 years in Iraq. We didn't have choice even for our TV channels. We didn't have choice to go to which college we want. We didn't have choice. Our choices were very limited. But we did have the choice within ourselves to go to the light or to choose other paths. And I made that choice. And it was the choice that I made. I love poetry, so I was reading a lot of novels and poetry. And one day, and we practice in Islam, we brought us as Muslim, we practice reading Quran, verses of Quran, as a way of worship. So it's a part of your prayer. You read a path of the Quran, a surah of the Quran, you read a verse of the Quran, you memorize a couple ones because of your daily prayer. But I never sat and read it and think about it. And in every verse, most of the verse, in every part, it says, think, think. So the book is telling you to think, but I'm not thinking. I'm just reading it. It's just for me, it's like reading it. So I looked at the book, the holy book of the Quran, beside the books of the great novels, the great Russian novels translated into Arabic. And I look at the book and I said, I'm going to read this book as not a holy book, as a book from an author. And I want to read everything, I want to understand it. That same as, and that's how my journey started. And that's how I get to the light. And when I say I got to the light, because I felt the light. After a year of reading and analyzing and going through the struggle and recognizing myself and why I am here, I was asleep. It was a near-death experience that I had, that I was dead body, and people were taking me to my final destination, but I had that feeling of ecstasy, that feeling that is not in the earth, that feeling that I cannot even describe in this, the words that we know, because it's a different feeling. And I was trying to tell everybody, don't cry. It is so good to be dead. That's how I was feeling. I was like, don't cry, mom. And I see my mom, she was reading prayers on me. And then they took me to the light. So I saw the light. And I was in the light. And then I woke up and I felt my body dead. But gradually my soul is getting back to my body. I open my eyes, says, oh God, Allah, why you did this? Why I am back again? That's how I experienced. So I knew through this time that I was reading and analyzing and trying to discover myself, I went through that experience. So I saw the light and I wanted to be there, and I didn't want to be back on this earth, but I was back. So there is a purpose why I was back. That's how I felt. And the purpose of being alive again, to discover myself again, what I can do. And that's where my work started with the children, as I told you, when I was trying to help the children for the malnourished women because of the sanction. I was seeing miracles every day, and I could feel it. And I was a part of helping the mothers and helping to heal and cure. We talk here about interfaith and what we say, why we need interfaith in this time. I remember when I came here, I had a piece of paper that has addresses, and I was walking in downtown Seattle by myself with my scarf. asking people, there was no internet at that time, I mean, smartphones, and to get Googles and find addresses. But I'm new, I don't know, and I'm finding addresses to apply for jobs. And I go to downtown Seattle and I saw somebody and they're like, can you help me? I want to go to this address. And they will help me. And everybody was smiling and everybody was so welcoming. And I felt that love and I loved it. And I tell my family about this new culture. I am here, but it is, they are the same. They are us. They are like us. And then I loved my life here, and then 9/11 happened. And everything changed. The morning of 9/11, I was driving my car with my little boy. He was 2 years and a half. And I just came back from a trip from Iraq, so I had a very beautiful song that my son would love, and he would clap, and he was 2 years and a half, he would clap with the song, he wanted the song, and I would repeat it in the car. I'm driving to my school. At that time, I was a teacher at the Islamic School of Seattle, in downtown Seattle. And in the morning, I put that song, didn't put it in the news, I put that song, I drove from Kent to downtown. And I have this song, and my son is clapping. And I would stop in every stop, and I clap and sing with him. The whole time I'm driving, clapping, singing to my Islamic School of Seattle, while 9/11 is happening, and people are hearing. And I would, they would see me in the car, I'm clapping and singing. The happiest person on earth. I just came back. I was charged. I saw my family. I saw my dad. I saw my mom. I had my son with me. He's happy. He likes the song. And I'm just repeating that song and clapping and singing. And I drove my car and I stand, and then I see the principal running to me in the parking lot. And then another teacher's running to me. And I have this song, and they were like knocking, open the door, and they were panicking. And I'm like, wow. I opened it and they said, turn off this, take off your scarf. And I'm like, why? What happened? And they told me, didn't you hear the news? And I said, no. And here we go. They told me, you're not safe. You have to take off your scarf, and maybe you call somebody to come and take you and get in the house and don't get out because 9/11 happened. That moment, my heart dropped because I hear the news. First, I start crying from that being this happy person to this being sad and crying because of the nature of what happened. People were shocked. Because of what happened, if you were shocked one time, I was shocked 10 times. Because that's not the religion that I know. And that's not the act that I was taught. And that's not the life that I know about. And that's not the teaching of what I learned since a child. And then they are hijacking a plane, killing people, but they're hijacking my religion with it. And now, we are not safe because people who don't know us, they know us through the lenses of what happened, the lenses of the TV or what happened. So I went back and I saw the second plane when I was home. I saw the second one happen and I tried to shield my child not to see what's going on at that time. But it was a moment of, oh, evil. You can see evil. You can smell evil. You can now see how the world is changing. That was the moment of the world changing. People are not smiling to me anymore. And that was very, very hard. And I had the Seattle Times at that time, they made a news story. And I'm saying, I'm not a terrorist. And I missed the smile. I smile, nobody smiles back at me. And that's when the time of interfaith was so important. Because our school were threatened. People sent threatening messages to kill all the kids in our school at that time. And then the beauty of interfaith, the beauty of community came out. We had people from our community. We have a priest. We have people from all kinds of colors. They came and they shielded our school. And they were there protecting us for a month, every day. And they said, that's not us. We will protect you. We will protect our community. From every, we don't see beauty unless there is ugliness. That's when the beauty comes out, very beautiful there. We don't see light of a candle clearly unless everything is dark. We were so touched by what the community offered. We were so blessed because we felt there are people who want us good and who believe that we are not the enemy. We are like you. And our religion is not the religion of evil and destruction and killing. We are all from the same source, from the same light, but we come together in different paths and different doors. But we go in the same spot. It's the light that I saw and felt. It is the light. So they started, the media of course started with their agenda, and the face of a Muslim became the face of a terrorist. The connection was a Muslim terrorist, a Muslim is terrorist, not a terrorist is a criminal, a terrorist is a person who used the religion to kill and do harm to people. We do assume that everybody can understand that, but unfortunately now I know with what we are now hearing and see, because people got hurt, people get killed because of hate. Innocent people going through their daily, they get attacked because they think that we are the other. In the land of God, which is the earth, there's no other. We are all together. And only through unity, through humanity, through our faith, the faithful faith, the real faith, we can stand up for the people who needs us. Interfaith programs like this make us closer to each other, make us understand each other through communication. Maybe there will be some language barrier between nation and a nation, but when it comes to the language of human, the real language of having, of all religion, is to do good deeds, to help the others. We are all the same. I will read some poem from Rumi. Rumi was a Sufi poet. The bestseller poet in the United States is Rumi till now. That's for the haters to know. Bestseller. A true lover doesn't follow any one religion. Be sure of that, since in the religion of love, there is no irreverence or faith. When in love, body, mind, heart, and soul does not even exist. Become this, fall in love, and you will not be separated again. And I have another part from Saint Augustine. What does love look like? It has the hands to help others. It has the feet to hasten to the poor and needy. It has eyes to see misery and want. It has the ears to hear the sighs and sorrows of men. And then one of the core commandments of Judaism is love your neighbor as yourself. Sometimes called this is the great commandment. So there are three religions. They all share love the same way, because it came from the same source. Thank you. And it's time now for questions and answers, if you like. Any questions? Yes, please. Good questions. So, when you see people are coming and risking their life, coming all the way from the United States to your small city in a time of uncertainty, and they try to help people because they have faith, because they believe in helping, and they cannot do their job without a communication. And you are the tool to communicate. And you are from the same place. These kids are your communities. Do you think that my life will be more valuable than the life of the person who came all the way to my city to help these kids? So that was a very... I knew that was dangerous. It was not an easy decision, but I took it because I wanted to help kids. The joy that you have when you see a child get well and go back to their family was priceless. My life was nothing to see that smile on that child. Okay. Yes, please.
You said you read the Quran and then you started to wear your scarf.
Yes.
Did you not as a child then or as a young adult wear?
No. Most of the families in Iraq, and that's one of the things that people think that everybody in the Muslim world that wearing hijab, no, it's not. In Iraq, for example, Iraq was a very secular country, and then you wear your scarf by choice if you want to practice what the Quran's telling you. You would wear scarf. That's how it was a choice. For example, in other countries like Saudi Arabia and Iran, there's no choice. Everybody has to wear it because the authority is demanding that. Yes, please. I studied 4 years of English literature. I graduated from College of Education. As a child, I didn't. In fifth grade, we start learning English. But it's just one class a week, and it's not that there's not a lot of emphasis on the language. But I studied English literature, so I have a degree in English to be a teacher. I was a high school teacher, but then I ended up to be a translator. Yes, please.
Sometimes it's interesting because I don't know how you feel that you have to tell and retell your story again and again and again and again. And you get tired. Sometimes, I mean, I say it because sometimes we have no choice as people of color, as minorities,
mm-hmm.
not from Mexico, for
example.
Mm-hmm. You have to retell your story all over and over and over and over. So sometimes it's a call to retell your story. I don't know how you feel. What is your thinking?
I never get tired telling my story. It's a very unique one, so I never get tired. I'm a survivor, so survivors don't get tired of telling their stories. But I tell you one thing. For humans to get connected, it's always through stories. We remember the stories from our grandparents, and we remember the stories from our parents. That's what we remember about them, because they were telling us a story. They were telling us their story, and then the story of our aunt and our neighbor. So it's all about stories. So stories makes you feel more connect as a human, because you know that, yes, that person is different from me, probably in skin, in culture, in religion, but, oh, they lived, they went to school, they had families, they have siblings, they lived in something. So these These connectors will help you to communicate more through stories. It's a proven method.
I understand your point.
Aren't we get tired of telling our story to tell you understand us, we are like you, and I know what you mean. Yes, to survive again, yes, you have to tell the story. Because we are in a not an ordinary time, by the way. We are in a very difficult time. And it's not just here, it's all the world. We are in a very difficult time. It's a test. I say, take it as a test. So you do your best to make people understand you, and then probably have an impact on the others. Maybe they will have even a little bit light they can take from you, and then they spread it and became a bigger light, and they go and share and they do good because they might take something from your story that inspires them. And that's the purpose of sometimes explaining ourselves. I know it is like sometimes I would say I'm not going to apologize for what's happening in the name of Islam, because that's not the religion that I believe in, and that's not the people that I grew up with, and that's not the one thing that I stand for. So why do I apologize because a terrorist blew himself? Well, most of the victims are Muslims in the world. And then my cousin and his mother in Mosul, 2 months ago, my cousin, his mother, and 7 of his cousins were executed by ISIS. I know victims, they are my family, who were Muslims, were killed by ISIS. And you will see in the Twitter people going on, Muslims are this Muslim, like that Muslim. Right now, the Iraqi army are liberating Mosul city. All of them are Muslims, liberating Muslims from ISIS, and nobody is talking about that. And when ISIS do something, the whole media goes wild. We'll talk about what the Muslims are doing and sacrificing, and what they are doing right now and they are Muslims. Why when the victim is a Muslim, nobody talks about it? When the liberator is a Muslim, nobody talks about that. So that makes us to wonder what is the agenda of these news outlets. The good thing, you are here. You're not watching Fox News or other news. So you get to know another part of the story without watching something that it is telling you. And believe me, in every country there's Fox News. And you know, we have it in back there. And we have a lot of misconceptions about other religions and other people. And the only way is through communication and know each other on a personal level. That's very important. So go make a friend with somebody who is different from you, different from your religion. That's the best book that you can read. It's free. And, you know, it is also a good way to learn. We always learn from each other. Yes, please.
Can you trace the behind the religion? It's just how.
Because it's truth. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Because that's the truth. So we Muslims feel we are victimized twice. Once by them and once by the rest of the world. And now people look at us in a different way. And some people want harm to us just because of the way I look or the way I dress. I can blend in if I take my scarf or make it blonde, maybe something. I can blend in. I was asking my husband the other day, I said, if I dye my hair blonde, can I blend in? He told me, no, you're not. And I said, why not? He said, no, you have the look. I said, which look? He said, no, you're different. I'm like, okay, I will never try, but yes, please.
Are your children discriminated against? Do they have problems at school?
My two boys are in public school, but my two girls are going to a Montessori school, which is a very diverse with people, all of them. But my son, when he was in middle school, he was called a terrorist from Iran. Apparently, the other American didn't know the geography very well. He thought he's from Iran. So he did have that issue. He was called terrorist from Iran. And he was telling him, I'm a Kurd from Iraq, not Iran, but he didn't know the geography. So. Another stereotype about Americans, they don't know geography. But I had some issues, I was lucky not to be killed. Some Somali women in Seattle were stabbed. Yeah, the day of 9/11, they were in the gas pump, and somebody came and stabbed them. And they, of course, the Sikh, we've seen them because of their turbans, they get killed. A couple of them. So yeah, I survived yet again. I hope I survive this 4 years again here. I hope, all hoping, I can survive. This 4 years. I am a tough cookie.
Was
yes.
Your family considered wealthy?
My family here or in... No, actually, my family were not very poor, but they were a little bit above. We were okay, but not high middle, no. My father was a bus driver, and my mom was just stay-home mom. And only my father would stop supporting 10 kids. So we were not, no. Yeah. No, we were not. And we never had the issue of why we are not wealthy, because we were happy being together, and the big family was at something there. And we had everything. Education was free and health was free, so that helped. That helped, yes, that helped. But my father was making enough money to make us live, and then my brother came to Canada. In 1990, he came to the Canada, and he worked, and he was sending us money. He was helping us. That's how I was able to finish school, because I went to school through the sanction on Iraq, and everything was very, very expensive. Like, imagine a dozen of eggs were, for example, $30. Can you afford it to have $30? Yeah. 1 kilo of rice was $40. Yeah. People were starving. The sanction was the worst thing happened. Not just the war. The sanction was very bad. Yeah. So it was very, very tough time. But my brother was helping, because, and then the difference between the dollars, the American dollars and the Iraqi dinars was huge. So he would send a couple hundred dollars, but we could live for a whole month at that time, because the difference in the currency. But he helped. I owe him everything that I could do there. Yeah. Yes, please.
So you went through a period from 86 to 88,
relatively good.
Yes, 88 to 90,
yes.
And that was under the Saddam Hussein.
Yes, yes.
So when after the Gulf War, when sanctions were put in place,
yes.
How did the Iraqi people feel about the U.S.? Because we were the leadership in putting those sanctions in place.
That's right.
And the people that were hurting the most were...
We were at Waya, not the regime, it was us. The people were still blaming Saddam for the whole thing, because we were blaming him for the war, we were blaming him for the sanction, but we felt betrayed. We did feel betrayed, because what happened before the sanction, when the U.S. troops came all the way from the south, they liberated Kuwait, and then they came all the way, they just were about to get to Baghdad, and then the Shia in the south, they uprised, right? So they pushed the regime back into Baghdad, then the Kurds uprised up when I was there, and we pushed So Saddam had only Baghdad and two other Anbar and Tikrit. Only three paths. And we were like, he's done. And Bush is going to come. And he's done. And we will be liberated. And that time, there was an agreement, because the U.S. Administration did not want the Shia, the majority of Iraq, to control, and they didn't want the influence of Iran on Iraq, and then Saudi and the Gulf states, the ally of the U.S., they pushed them, they said, no, if the regime is gone now, the replacement will be the Shia, and we don't want that. So there was the agreement between the U.S. Government and the Iraqi that they did they end the war, and they gave them the right to use their helicopters. So what Saddam did after it's all done, took the troops, massacre the people who uprise in the south, the Shia, and then the same troop came up, and I was there, and start entered our cities, and everybody, 1 million people went to the mountain. If you remember, that was a human catastrophe. Yeah, 1 million people. People died from just being cold and disease. We stayed in the city, and we saw the troops and everything. And I was an eyewitness, a helicopter bombing civilians. And then I walked on the pieces of people in the street. That's how I witnessed the whole thing. And then we see the American jet fighters come very close. And we'll say, hey, Bush is now gonna, hit the helicopters of the Iraqi army. They wouldn't. You could tell the frustration of these jet fighters. They would come close. They tried to do anything, but they cannot because there's an agreement. And we were crushed. We were crushed.
So, for all,
of course.
2011, whatever it was that we invaded Iraq, would be wrong.
So, being wrong and right, I have to. Am I an Iraqi or am I an American? Because if I'm an Iraqi, I wanted anything in the earth to happen to take this regime away. Because it wasn't 33 years of his regime. He was having his two sons waiting for to take over. And they were cruel. I'm talking about today is the memory of 1986, Saddam used the chemical weapons against the Kurds in Halabja. 5,000 people, women, children died in hours. Today is the commemorate of their death. And then 180,000 people were in mass graves. Kurds, children, everybody. And talking about ISIS, by the way, ISIS is a part of this regime, which the media is not putting it together, but we know Iraqis, they are the remains of Saddam. Then being an American, and see, we are, at that time, in 1991, we were helping another nation that were in need, Kuwait. I mean, Saddam and committed atrocity in that city. I mean, people were raped, people were killed, people were, the whole country was gone. So it was the whole community, international community, wanted to help to get this. But why we didn't get rid of Saddam at that time and we will be done? That was a mistake, I think, in my opinion. That was a mistake. And then we carried on. He crushed his people. And then another war. And that's when the second war happened. A lot of Americans were against it. And the whole world were against it because this is a war on people. But we Iraqis were happy because Saddam is going to go. But we were thinking that America, the United States, has good plans. They know, they plan, they know what they are doing. But we discovered they didn't know anything. It was a culture shock for me there. I'm like, I know. they plan, like, for this event, you plan like 2-3 weeks, a month ahead. You know, you plan, you remind, you plan. I mean, they know what they're doing, but no, they didn't know what they're doing. And they send people who don't know anything about the culture. There were kids from small towns into the army, and they didn't know anything about anything. That's where the mistakes happened, and that's when the whole thing went another route. But the purpose for the Iraqis, we welcomed the Americans, yes we did. We wanted to get rid of Saddam. It was an opportunity for us. Because guess what? Saddam was backed by the United States all the 80s, all the beginning of 90s. It was their guy. He was their guy, right? He was our ally against Iran, the evil, right? We were pushed to war with Iran because of Saudi Arabia doesn't like Iran, and they are ally and we are ally. So the whole circle is always, until now, if you look at the what's going on in the Middle East, it's all about Iran and Saudi Arabia. The whole thing is about these two forces. And Saudi Arabia, they have money and oil. So they do control on our decisions here in the United States. They do have a say. They do. We called it our ally, but they do have. They do have. So, yes, please.
What is the point of destroying all the activities that we see happening now in that part of the country?
You mean the ISIS? For people of Iraq, we know that Saddam's son-in-law had an operation. We call it the underground operation, but everybody we know. And he was training in all the historical and the remains of our history in Iraq. And he would sell it to the people in Europe. He had that as a business. We know that. And he would make fake, replace the fakes, take the big ones, couldn't take it, but the small ones, he was doing that. The whole family were having business of taking, the whole Iraq was their own land, their own. They were entitled, that they were thinking they're entitled, everything is theirs because of the power. So, as I mentioned before, ISIS was a part of the remainers of Saddam's Republican Guard, the army, and the Fidayu Saddam, there was a special elite of Saddam. They are now all the leaders of ISIS. They are all leaders of ISIS. Those are remainers of Saddam. They are now leaders of ISIS, yes. So we know that this is because Saddam, when he vowed, he said, I won't leave Iraq. If I leave it, it will be, it just remains. Nothing will, I will destroy the whole country for you. And they did. They did. So after he was, especially after he was not assassinated, he was executed. By the way, he was executed on the same spot where my uncle was executed because of his political view, and my husband's brother were executed because of political view. Look at the karma. It's working. The same spot. And so his family, Saddam's family, his daughters and his wife, they flee the country, but they took billions and billions of dollars and gold and everything. They empty all the banks. They took this money, went to Qatar and Jordan. What they are doing there? Spending money on what? Supporting these groups. They want the power back. It is not done for them. ISIS is getting funded by Saddam's family and by some of these countries in the Gulf world. Because now, who has the power in Iraq? The Shia. Who doesn't like the Shia? The Gulf states. Because they are the Sunni, they don't like the Shia. And now Iraq changed from being a Sunni-controlled country, where the Sunni were minorities, not the majority, but they were controlling, to a Shia controlled country, and they don't like it, backed by Iran. So the whole struggle is there. So when ISIS came in Mosul, the first thing they start this video thing and destroying all the, they call it the idols, because they believe that the people are worshipping idols, and it shouldn't be, there shouldn't be any idol in any place. So those are just idols, you should just destroy them. But it was a cover of what their business again, the business of selling all these the small statues and the small parts. The small were all sold. Were all sold, yes. That's how they get funded for their organization. Oil and the ruins, yes. We're getting to politics, but this is how life it is, right? Yes? Going from the light and the enlightenment to politics, which is the source of hate. Yes, please.
Say the Arab countries, there's not such much freedom. Mm-hmm. The children are growing up here in the United States. What would be the reaction if the doctor came home one day and said, I'm being married to a Christian boy?
Good question. So in Islam, as we raised, Muslim women only marry Muslim men. They don't marry from the other faith, any faith. So that's how we were raised. And we had Christians in Iraq, and there were a lot of these kinds of story happening that a woman fell in love with a Muslim, a Christian woman in Iraq will fell in love with a Muslim. Guess what the reaction of their family was? She will be killed from a Christian family in Iraq. She will be killed. They don't accept that. Muslims don't accept it, and the Christians don't accept it, and the Jews didn't accept it too. So the choice was about how the girl will decide. She would, we call it, she run away. She would run away, she would leave her family, and they devour her. She will run away, and she will marry that person. Either she made the most, the, you know, the biggest mistake in their life, because men, you cannot predict them, how good they are. Or, and then she lost both family and her new life. Or they will live happily after, and we have a lot of stories of life. I came here carrying this luggage with me. I came as a small luggage, remember I told you? But I carry other luggages with me, which is inside. And we all carry luggages, because we are in a journey. And this life is a transition. But not a lot of people look at it. We go and we just go shop and buy and put luggages. Sometimes it's free, sometimes it's imposed on us, but we carry a lot of luggages. But when we came to this life, we came without anything. Naked. No luggages, nothing. Pure. But we came from another spiritual life. There is another life there. And we are going to another life, another spiritual life, and we take every, we leave everything behind. We go back there too. Just a spiritual being. To continue our journey, because we are in a journey. So I came with these luggages. And I came to, I have to adapt myself and my beliefs to now to a new place. Do I do accept that? I ask this question a lot of time. I have discussion with my husband about this particular, are we ready if our daughters came or even our son and say, I want to marry somebody from another? And my answer was, yes, yes, because of the freedom, but because I told you, I chose my religion as a choice, not as because I was born from a Muslim family. I chose, but that was a choice. I, for myself, and I say it with a full conscience, I will say yes. And the reason is, if my daughter decided and she got to the point that she wants to marry somebody from another faith, why not? And I say it because if we can communicate in human level now, why they cannot communicate in there's a there's a true love between them. Should be true love that makes all the boundaries gone. And I don't believe in boundaries. Maybe my family wouldn't agree with me. Maybe my husband wouldn't agree with me, or my husband, but that's my... I say it consciously, and because I do believe that the essence and the of everything in life starts from the pure love. And that is when it comes and it's real, I think there should be no obstacles. And I have my story with my husband is through this, because he's Shia and I'm Sunni. Two different sects. And nowadays, not a lot of intermarital relations in Iraq because of the sectarian violence. But we, against all the odds, we got married when there was a peak of the sectarian violence. The peak of sectarian violence, we did it. Do we fight? Yes. Do we argue about our sects and which sect is better than the other one? Oh yeah. Do we love each other? Truly? Yes. That erases everything. Which is our truth. We are from love. And whatever comes to change us, that's when we get changed to another being, which is not us. Sometimes you look at yourself and say, this is not me, when you are angry and you are, this is not me, I'm not like this. Yes, go back to yourself. It's within. You go back to yourself. You are pure love, because you came from pure love. God, Allah is love. That's it. Any other questions? You are very welcome. Thank you so much. Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you.